Now it's time to be educated and entertained by the country's most famous environmental scientist, Joey Bia's research grizzly bears, wolves, and birds of prey. He continues to travel all across America to bring you the very best that nature has to offer. Be ready to be amazed. Here's your host, Joey B.
Hello and welcome to Joey B. Outdoor Science and Nature. Man, do I have the coolest job. I travel all across America to bring you the very best that nature has to offer. Today's show is spring migration in the Sourlands, and I have a great guest today. She is a retired research scientist who is now a naturalist and is president of the Washington Crossing Audubon Society. Juanita Hummel, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Joey. It's great to be here.
I am excited about this because when I have some great guests on, I get to learn quite a bit. So I'm excited for myself as well today. So let's start with this. Why do some birds migrate in the spring?
Well, that's a good question. And nobody can really say for sure, but there are some theories. One of them is that, well, the short answer is that they're here for food. In the tropics, where many of their ancestors originated, there are lots more birds. There's lots more competition for food, for nesting places. And the theory is that during the last, just after the last ice age, as the glaciers pulled back and the land became uncovered and vegetation began to grow again, some of these birds started extending their ranges up into these northern climates, and they found a lot of things. First, there was more food there for them because there were fewer birds. There were also more nesting places where they could nest without competition from other birds. And there the food, a single oak tree that grows here can actually act as a host for up to about 350 different caterpillar and butterfly species that lay their eggs on it and produce caterpillars. And that is one of these migrating birds' favorite foods. So when they come here in the spring, they find lots of food, lots of nesting places, and interesting, we don't think about this too much, longer days. I had the privilege of traveling to the Arctic a few years ago, where of course, the land of the midnight sun, and the birds there were active finding food and feeding their babies about 20 hours out of every 24-hour day. And those birds can produce about 4 to 6 eggs on average per clutch, whereas tropical birds on average only can produce 2 or 3. So while it seems like, and it is true that there are lots of hazards to making a long migration, there are also advantages as well. And so these birds are taking advantage of those advantages.
Well, here's a question for you based on what you just said. Sure. The birds that are only having a clutch of 2 or 3 eggs, is that because there's so much competition for whether nesting or food in the area?
Yes, exactly. There's a lot more population pressure on those birds.
All right, so here's my next question. Why is the Sourland region important for long-range migratory birds in particular?
Well, these birds need a few things when they're making these long migrations. They need places to put down and feed along the way. Some of them are coming from as far south as the southernmost part of South America. And some of them are heading all the way to the Arctic or to the boreal forest, which is sort of up to the tree line in Canada where the Arctic starts. And that requires a lot of energy, and they have to have places to rest and to feed on their way. And the Sourland region, because of its location along the Atlantic Flyway, I should explain there are 4 major flyways in the United States, 1 on each coast and 2 in the center. And in the springtime, wind and weather patterns are set up that makes it easier for birds to follow. So they have tailwinds, and they have the winds that help carry them up north on their migration. So they tend to follow one of those pathways. And we're on the Atlantic Flyway, runs along the Atlantic coast. And so thousands of years ago, when the birds came up that pathway, they found the entire area forested and covered in trees. When they come these days, they find it all patchy. There are cities, there are human habitations, factories, areas that have been cleared for farms. And so those birds, particularly the wood warblers, as the name suggests, they prefer woodlands, have found far fewer places to put down and rest, or for the ones who want to breed in this area, far fewer places to breed these days. So the Sauerland Mountains is, let me see, I think it's 25,000 acres of contiguous forest. And it's the only area that looks like that between the Pinelands and then the northern part of New Jersey and the southern part of New York State, where you start to see a few forested areas again. And it's completely surrounded by development. So when they see that, they typically migrate at night, and just before dawn, they put down wherever they happen to be, feed, and then rest. As they're coming up that Atlantic Flyway, this is one of the areas that they see that looks like it might be good to rest in, and in fact, it is. And so, and it's one of the few places, well, it's the only place in central New Jersey where they have this opportunity.
And I also noticed, again, now living in the Sauerlands myself, a bordering neighbor, so to speak, of you, as well, which is a neat thing. But I've noticed that there is so much preserved land here in the Sauerlands. And to me, that was one of the reasons that drew me to this area.
That's true. In fact, we're part of what's known as the Sauerland Regional Important Bird Area. That was designated by the National Audubon Society. And it consists of those many thousands of acres of forest I mentioned, plus many more tens of thousands of acres of agricultural grasslands and agricultural lands. And some of those are managed for grassland birds. And so, I should mention that this IBA, the Sauerland Regional IBA, is a continentally important IBA. So there you have IBAs at the state level, at the country level, and at the continental level. And so that this is an important area for on a North American continental basis. In other words, a lot of birds actually rely on this area for their survival, either the ones that breed here or the ones that are going farther north as they pass through.
Nice. And this show is brought to you by Ramsey Outdoor Stores. Whether you shop online or in one of their stores, your experience will successfully gear you up for your next adventure. Go to ramseyoutdoor.com. So now, what are some of the migratory birds that breed here in the Sauerlands, and why do they breed here?
Well, that's another good question. One of my favorites is the scarlet tanager. That's a bright red bird with black wings. Anybody that's the bird that has triggered many a casual observer of nature to become a birder. And that bird is a bird that requires a large area of canopy, so tall trees. It likes to sit up and do all its singing and its nesting in the upper reaches of the canopy. And it will not breed if it doesn't have that kind of a forest. So as a result, it's really starting to lose habitat because it can't find those big areas of contiguous forest to breed in anymore. That one winters in Central and South America. There's another bird that I consider the signature bird of the Sauerland. That's the oven bird. And you've probably been here long enough to hear that singing in the summer, that teach, 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 teacher song out in the woods. And that bird lives on the forest floor. So it's at the complete opposite, they're completely different from the scarlet tanager. It tends to winter in Florida, Mexico, and also in Central America. But what it's looking for is large areas of deciduous forest with lots of dead leaves on the forest floor, because that's what it makes its nest out of. And it's called an oven bird because the nest that it fashions out of these dead leaves looks a little bit like an old-fashioned bread oven. And even though it's a forest floor breeder, it's really difficult to see the nest. It's so well camouflaged by fitting in with all the other surrounding dead leaves. And finally, there's another bird that's really important in the Sauerlands. That's the Louisiana water thrush. And that's a bird that actually lives on stream banks. It has a long, narrow territory along the stream bank, and it's been said that this bird is a better indicator of healthy, unpolluted water quality than chemical testing, because it will only choose the streams that are pristine. And here in the Sauerlands, we have those kinds of streams. So you will hear these birds singing throughout the Sauerlands. They make their nests on the banks of streams, in hollow logs or a tangle of roots or maybe a little hole in the bank. And they sing from the sides. The males will protect a territory sometimes along a stream bank that's almost a mile long. So it's a big, long, narrow territory. And they feed in the middle of the stream because they eat little invertebrates and water insects. And if you ever see a little stripy bird hopping down the middle of a stream from rock to rock, almost certainly you've seen Louisiana water thrush. Well, those are some of our favorites.
No, as you're describing all of these, because one of the questions I had was, what was going to be some of your favorites? Mm-hmm. And I have not seen a scarlet tanager yet, and I am so excited to see one. I remember when I first moved in and I chatted with you, and I saw the pileated, and I was like, so exuberant, because I was so excited. And now I see pileated like every day, and the smile is still the same. You know, it's funny with birders, we never get tired of seeing the same bird because every day it's got a new antic, whatever it's doing, but you just get just as excited as the first day you ever saw it.
That's true. That's absolutely true. I'm glad you see it that way too, because a lot of people, you know, you tend to say, oh, just another whatever, another sparrow or just another blue jay. But when you get to know them and you get to understand their behavior, you just become very, very fond of them.
Now, like, here's a bird that I've been hearing. I've been working on the farm, you know, just getting things in order the way I want it. And I've been hearing a rufous-sided towhee. And I'm like, you talk about some of your favorite birds. The call is one of my favorite birds by call. And I'm just working out there, and I got a smile on my face. And if he calls for 2 hours, I smile for 2 hours. It's just the greatest
Those
thing.
Those are wonderful birds.
Yes. And another bird, before I had closed on the farm, I was walking out in the back in the pond behind my home. I'm walking back there, and there is a wood duck with one of her chicks in the pond. I took some great photos of that, but I'm just saying, it's like, I'm talking about me personally now, I'm in paradise by living where I live and seeing what I see.
Well, after 36 years here, I agree with you.
Thank you very much. And hopefully after 36 years, I have the same big old smile on my face when I see that pileated.
It really gets into your blood, and it gets very hard to leave.
That's a good thing. I'm excited about that. Yes. Now, and I've got this problem on my farm, but I'm sure down by you as well. The ash trees are dying. Emerald ash borer is destroying them. I actually have a tree man coming in to remove some of the dead ash trees on Monday at a major cost, very expensive to get them removed. But how is that going to affect the birds? Because so much of the area are ash trees.
That's going to have a huge effect, especially because the ash trees are part of the canopy story. So they tend to grow very tall, and they tend to be part of this contiguous canopy that some birds require, like I was mentioning earlier, the scarlet tanager, and also, as it happens, the pileated woodpecker. So for now, the pileateds are doing pretty well because they eat the larvae of the ash borers. The dead trees are also themselves becoming infested with carpenter ants, all things that pileateds like. And that's one of the reasons that everybody is saying, I'm seeing them so often here. It's actually a sign that they're finding more food because of the dying ash trees. But eventually this is going to open up the canopy so much that our woods are going to change. They're not going to be this big contiguous forest anymore. And there are some birds who are not going to find it as attractive. They just simply won't be able to breed here. Fortunately, we do have the Sauerland Conservancy. I know you've been talking to people from the Sauerland Conservancy,
yes,
who have a huge, ambitious project to plant thousands and thousands of trees over the next few years to try and mitigate this canopy opening. So they're planning planting trees that are going to eventually grow up and replace the dying ashes, trees that will grow tall and help to repair the canopy before it's too late. But it may already be too late for certain sensitive species. That's very worrisome to all of us.
Question for you, and I have a number of beeches in the forested part of my farm. Is the beech an answer as a replacement tree?
Well, you actually need a variety of trees. The best kind of tree, if you can get it to grow, is oak. Different species of oak, because they do provide food for so many different caterpillars, and that in turn provides food for the birds. So that's probably the single best tree to plant. But our forest is a mixture of different trees that have different interactions with different species of insects. So you do want a mixture. And the Sauerland Conservancy is planting a mixture of trees. We have a lot of tulip trees here, which are the tallest tree on the East Coast. They're a good, like, quick fix for a big open space, because they grow very quickly. And they literally grow with hardly any branches. They put all their effort into getting up into that canopy as quickly as possible. So that's a good option also for a quick fix. But we do eventually need all of our trees back again. So it would be nice to have the ash back again someday. And the state and entomologists are working on biological controls for the ash borer. There's three different types that attack it at all different stages of its life cycle. And they are optimistic that someday we will have our ashes back again. It's not going to be eliminated like the chestnuts and the elms, but it's too late for the big trees. So, but we may save some of the small ones. So eventually. But we're talking 20, 30, 40 years from now, we'll have our forest back.
I mean, when I have that smile on my face still from seeing the pileated, when I'm seeing the ash trees return as well.
Right.
Now, the National Audubon has studies that have shown North America has lost about one third of its bird population since 1970. What threats do migratory birds face along their route, and what can we do about it?
Well, they do face quite a few, apart from the usual things like predators getting caught up in bad weather, hurricanes, storms, etc., that can literally knock them right out of the sky. They're also being affected by humans. Lights at night, for example, can attract hordes of migratory birds to the cities, and they just become confused and circle around and around. So a lot of cities now are doing a lights out during migration. People who track birds will let them know there's a big migratory night coming up. And for example, the Empire State Building will turn off its lights in New York, and Philadelphia has jumped on that bandwagon, Baltimore, some of the bigger cities on the East Coast. But we can do that too by trying to reduce the amount of light we have at night in our communities to a level that's minimal, so as, again, not to attract birds and make them confused, because some of them do follow the moon, for example, or stars along their migratory route, and this can be very confusing. Most of these the small songbirds migrate at night, because the raptors migrate during the day, so they feel safer at night. And there are a couple other things too that affect them on the ground. For example, cats, people who leave their cats outdoors, cats kill billions of birds every year. The Audubon Society has determined that they are the single largest killer of birds nationwide. And people don't realize that, because they don't even see their cats killing the birds. You know, I've observed a couple of my cats actually take birds. We had one cat, it was a feral cat. We tried to keep it indoors. It kept going outdoors. It was an excellent bird killer, unfortunately. But try and keep your cats indoors if you can. And window kills, that's another big thing. If you have windows there are certain types of windows that reflect light in a way that looks like to the bird that they're about to fly into the woods.
Yes.
And in fact, they end up hitting a window. So there are a number of things you could do. Screening windows is very good. It prevents the reflection and the birds will just bounce off the screen. Or there's something called Zen curtains, which are just little pieces of parachute cord you can hang in front of your window just to break up the reflection. And that will help save billions of birds every year as well. And we're trying to get people who live in or work in big glass office buildings to also do something and install bird safe glass, especially if they're building a new building. But that's a slow process.
Well, you think about in the cities, how many buildings are just made basically just of windows? Glass.
Yeah. Very, it kills thousands of birds. There are people who go around and document this. They go after a big migratory night, they'll go around to the bases of buildings and pick up the dead birds and see what types they were and determine how many different species of warblers got killed overnight in any particular city. It's frightening, actually.
Now, do we have a number of warblers that will nest here in the Sauerlands?
Yes, we do have about, I think we've got something like, well, certainly about 35 species can be seen here. I think it's something like pretty close to that number have, actually nest here. We have some very birds with very specific habitat needs, like the Kentucky warbler that nest in the Sauerlands, but not anyplace else around here. About of all the birds that come through the Sauerlands, about half of them are under some sort of threat in New Jersey. So that means that it's really important that we try and give them a good home while they're here so that we can keep them around.
Well, so here, my next question is this, because you may have a novice birder listening to this podcast show. And if we're going to talk to them about, they're going to go out to start to do some birding, what are some of the field guides you might recommend? And maybe even a pair of binoculars, that's something that's not super expensive that rookie can get, so we can get other people into the area and birding.
Well, fortunately, there are quite a number of bird guides available. There's a really good one if you have a smartphone. It's called Merlin. It's an app from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, which you can download onto your phone and take it out in the field with you. And it allows you to enter field marks, like what color is the bird, what does the beak look like, how big is it, and it knows your location if you allow it location access, and it can tell you what you might be looking at. So that for a beginning birder, I think is the easiest. There's a kind of a joke we have that novice birders see more rare birds than people with many years of birding experience. And of course, they're not really seeing rare birds. They're just, when you go through your field guides and you're looking for something and you say, oh, that looks like it. You don't have any idea whether it's even found in your neighborhood in the winter or whatever. But I would recommend the website allaboutbirds.org, that's from the Cornell Labs, and that website has everything you could possibly want to know about birds. They offer beginner birding courses, they offer advanced birding courses, they have all kinds of information. You could spend a day just trolling through all the different sections on that website and you would come away with a great deal of knowledge about birds. And as far as migratory birds go, if you want to have a little fun, you can go to my website, birdcast.info, that's how you get there. And it shows you live migratory live bird migrations being tracked by radar across the United States. And I just had a brief look at it before I came on here. And last night at peak time, there were 200 million birds in flight across the United States migrating up from Central and South America. And you can just watch this radar sweep go across the country. And you can see the radar lighting up as the birds start at dusk down in the south, start moving up northwards towards the northern parts of the country. It's really fascinating. I'd recommend everybody go there and just have a look.
See, as I told you, I was going to learn many things. That's a site I have not been to, so that one will excite me. When you spoke about Merlin, one of my friends is an assistant superintendent of schools, and he's an outdoorsman, and he's learning more and more about birds, and he uses the Merlin site on his phone as he's hiking along. I know that. And the Cornell ornithology site you mentioned is spectacular. So it doesn't matter whether you're a rookie birder or a, you know, call it expert birder, there's always something for you on that site.
Something for everybody, absolutely. There are things you can do with children if you want to get your family interested in nature, all kinds of ideas, information about feeding birds, about bird houses. It's just fabulous, really fabulous site.
That is a neat thing. So here's my question for you about you. Tell me about your next bird adventure outside of the Sourlands.
Actually, I'm just planning now a trip to Colombia in South America. That is the country in the world with the largest number of species of birds. And we're going to be visiting the mountainous part of it. So the Andes, the Colombian Andes on both the Caribbean side and the other side. There are different habitats on both sides, so you see different kinds of birds. It's the interesting thing is that there is a bird that we have here, the Canada warbler, that actually spends most of its winter in that place, but it's not going to be there when I go. We're going in July, and so it will be up here and in Canada while I'm down there, so I won't be seeing it this year, but it is fun to go to the tropics in the winter and see all the birds that you saw passing through or living here down there for the winter with you. It's great. So I'm really looking forward to that. I'm anticipating seeing several hundred species of birds while I'm there.
To me, that's a great adventure. So I'm going to put you on this spot. And because I know that you've traveled worldwide tracking birds, tell me your favorite bird you've ever seen.
Oh my gosh, that is so hard. Every new bird that I see is my favorite bird that I've ever seen. But I can't even pick one. There's so many extraordinary birds. I can't even think of one that I would pick as my favorite. There are just too many.
Yeah, I was about to say, and that's the great thing about birding, because everywhere you go, or again, for me, I've done a lot of research out west, and all of a sudden I go out west and I see a bird I've never seen before. And mm-hmm. one of my buddies, he's got his life list, and I'll tell him, oh, I saw one. He's going, oh no, he's so excited. And I'm going, Mike, it's just, to me, I don't mean it this way. I'm going, Mike, it's just another bird, because I know it's killing him because he doesn't have that on his life list.
Well, it's something as simple as a northern cardinal, which is a pretty spectacular bird, you know, with its red and black and its very colorful and its crest on its head and everything. I was once leading a bird walk up in Canada. Before COVID, I used to go up. I would be thinking about going up to Canada like in a couple of weeks, following the birds up north and do some fundraising bird walks for the Bird Observatory up there in Bird Studies Canada, which is the Canadian equivalent of the Cornell Labs. And they do partner together on a lot of bird migratory activity. And I had a woman who was on one of my walks from Western Canada. She just moved to Ontario, transferred for a job. And every time she saw a cardinal, they have a different type. They have pyrloxy in some parts of the West, which is a cardinal relative, but it's pale in comparison to our cardinals. She would just go crazy, you know, and it's like, we're all, oh, it's another cardinal, you know, what are you so excited about? But that's how it works. It's something new and novel and beautiful, and it's thrilling.
And absolutely. You know, it's funny. One of my favorite birds is the female cardinal in the wintertime in the snow with the little orange and the beak. And like, I people always look at the male and go, there's great beauty in that male. But when you look at the female, especially in the wintertime, like near the feeders or something, that to me is one of my favorites.
Yeah, she's got a lot more variety in her plumage. She's got a little bit of the red too, but she's got some other colors as well. Mm-hmm. We have to... A lot of these female birds, if they didn't have a male who was so much more spectacular, would be very much more admired. I think like female orioles, for example, which are very pretty. Female Baltimore orioles, quite pretty in her own right, but her mate is so brilliantly orange and with a contrasting black that everybody looks at him. And of course, that is the reason why these male birds are so brightly colored. They want everybody, including predators, looking at them while the female quietly looks after the family on the nest and does not really want to be seen.
Again, a little piece of nature that is an important piece of nature.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, Juanita, I just want to let you know that this has been a great show because I have learned so much from you, and I thank you so much for your time spending here on the show today.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it very much. I always love talking about birds.
I could see that, and I could see the love. Until next time, enjoy life's adventures.
You can follow all of my adventures online at joeybee.tv. That's joeybee.tv. And a very special thank you to the men and women of our armed forces for keeping us free, and for our police and firefighters for keeping us safe. May God bless America. Until next time, this is Joey B. Enjoy life's adventures.